Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our new website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans, and welcome to episode number 231 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is July 30th, 2012. Got a big show for you this week on the Peristyle Podcast. Got a bunch of questions, and we'd love to hear from you if you do have questions. First way, you can email us, podcast@uscfootball.com, or give us a call, 206-888-6755. Leave a brief voice message, and we will play it on the podcast. Or you could go to peristylepodcast.com, our website that hosts the Peristyle Podcast. Click on the left side of the page and leave a voice message right from your computer. We got Dan Weber coming up later on the show. We got some USC questions for him, and there's some Penn State questions, too, that we got to get to. Also, as always, we love to kick off the show with Coach Harvey Hyde right in the very first segment, right out of the gate. We got to go to Coach. What's up, Coach? How are you doing?
Everything's going great. I'll say football season is close by, getting hyped up for it, as everyone is. It's going to be a very challenging season. I enjoyed Pac-12 Media Day, Ryan. I didn't see you there, but I was there sitting by myself where no one bothers me, where I can hear everything like I do when I go to the scrimmages. And I enjoyed the whole day there, and also I'm getting ready to get started here, and I hope we have some questions that we can answer. And before long, it'll be all here.
Certainly do. And 1 week away from the start of fall camp, and I was at Pac-12 Media Day. We'll talk with Dan Weber about that a little bit later. I want to get some of your initial thoughts on that too, Coach, right after. I want to thank our sponsor, Southern California Tickets. You can go to sctickets.com for all your ticketing needs, anything you need, or call them 1-800-888-7287. Give them a try, sctickets.com. You got USC right in the name. What else could you do better? But, Coach, what did you think about Pac-12 Media Day? I was kind of scrambling around writing stories and stuff, but I didn't see you, unfortunately. But what did you think of the whole day?
Well, I liked the setting. I think the parking was a little difficult. There's a lot of people there at Universal Studio. But the thing that impressed me was the seating. It was air-conditioned. It was nice inside. There was plenty of fluids and liquids for people to drink. The lunch was great. The presentations were good. I would have liked to have heard the head coach talk a little bit more when they first came out about their program. What's been going on since the season ended as far as coaching changes, people who left, red shirts who played well in the spring, how their spring practice went, and then sort of roll into the season, setting everybody up for where we are today as far as the opening of camp. And I'd like to have heard maybe the players talk a little bit more and have the questions equally distributed among the players. Some questions went to just Matt Barkley or whomever. Some players that were there, I even wonder why they came. Maybe they answered one question. If you know, you were there. You saw that.
Yeah.
And I would think it could be a little bit more organized to a point where it isn't such a rushed event where you have to get done by a certain time, but the head coach has more time as far as talking about his program, coaching changes, the spring, what changes have been made, so that people really have a real focus on what they expect this coming year.
I agree, and they had no dessert, Coach, which I did not like that. But I did like the setting. It was open space. We were at Fox Lot last year, and it was very cramped as far as the seating, but plenty of space in that auditorium at Gibson Amphitheater at Universal Studios. But there was a lot of Pac-12 network duties that coaches and players had to perform. So we had a hard time grabbing guys, even trying to get, you know, we did stuff for other rivals' networks, for other rival sites, like trying to grab Oregon State. We couldn't get Mike Riley by himself afterwards. I'm like, who's talking to Mike Riley? But they had a really busy, you know, post podium time up there, and it was hard to grab people. And it was really only like a half a day, you know, basically started in the morning and ended just after lunch. You know, I think you could spread it out over a full day. Mike Leach, coach, could have been a whole day to himself. He's just so entertaining. But yeah, they need to do it a little bit better. You look at the SEC, it's 3 days. They got a golf tournament. You'd like to get, you don't need 3 days, but maybe more than a half a day would be better.
I agree with you 100%. I had the opportunity, when I grabbed all the coaches, Ryan, is when they all came in together and they had the team picture out in front, not the team picture, but the picture of all the coaches and all the players they brought. I had an opportunity to run around and talk to a couple, not all of them, as many as I could at that time. And otherwise, they had responsibilities as soon as they got off the stage to go somewhere else or somewhere else or somewhere else. So you really didn't have a chance to really say hi. In my case, I just want to say hi, how things are going, how's your dad, blah, blah, blah. I remember when you were a ball boy, you know, just have some fun. Yeah, but that wasn't there because the guys tried to jam. They had them scheduled too tightly.
Yeah, there was a lot of media obligations, and the Pac-12 networks kind of added to the hustle and bustle, I guess you could say. They were taking pictures, doing all kinds of stuff, but whatever, we'll see. Hopefully it'll be a little different next year.
I agree. I agree. Maybe that's why I have a problem getting a credential, huh?
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm just kidding. I just tell you the way I feel, you know?
No, I love it, Coach. Well, we got a bunch of questions I wanted to get to. We'll start off with some USC ones, and then we're going to talk about Silas Red, the potential Penn State transfer, which seems to be breaking kind of stuff all the time here. But first up is Ben. He wanted to know, Kiffin has commented about using more 3 wide receiver sets in 2012. Am I correct to assume that a third wide receiver would substitute for one of the running backs? How does that work, Coach?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that you have to get your best talent on the field, utilize your passing game, but I think you should also utilize your other positions you have on the field. I mean, you have some great tight ends. I don't know. They might move a couple of them to the defensive end now. I'm not sure. But I'll tell you, you go from 3 wides to 3 big tight ends in the game that they all can run, and they all put you at a disadvantage trying to cover them, plus they're great on run blocking. So if you do both, you drag them across the field and run corners and do different things with these guys, with play action pass off of the set when they're great run blocking, you can cause a lot of problems there too. I don't like to see FC just get in a 2-back set on short yardage situations. I think that's I just don't like that. And I think that you've got to be able to do it more and believe in it more. And I'd love to have them have a short yardage offense. You know, right now, I don't know what their short yardage offense is, except for maybe blast or power. But I'd like to see them, you know, come in with double tights, not say copying Stanford, but very similar to what Stanford does in short yardage situations. Come down, have 3 or 4 tight ends in the game, and just say, hey, well, yes, we are coming there. We're definitely coming there. Can you stop us? It's just a challenge. I mean, we're coming there. If you can stop us, that's fine. And then occasionally play action pass out of it or go the opposite way with the same thing. And I'd like to see him believe in it, because I don't think everything is, you know, is not coming off the line blocking. And when you go down to the goal line situation, people are in the gaps, and they're blowing across trying to stop you. So you've got to have a blocking scheme when you're down there on the goal line that stops the penetration, blocking down, kicking out, running through, leading through, hooking if the end comes down, different schemes to be able to get off the line of scrimmage with your offensive line or block down to take away penetration. And I would like to see them have a goal line or short yardage package that you just believe in. You run about 3 or 4 plays off of it. You just say, here I come. Who's the best? Are you going to stop us? Are we going to get our first down or touchdown? And if you start to teach it that way and you believe in that type of philosophy, it works. But if you don't, then I think you're at a disadvantage. I think you got to really sell that early and believe in it. And when you have the type of tight ends that USC has, wow, I'm going to tell you, that could be awesome.
Well, and then we saw towards the end of last year, Coach, that they were utilizing the tight ends more. They were running the ball better. But in the beginning of the year, it seemed to be Matt Barkley to Robert Woods, and that kind of leads us to our next question. Paul E. from Burbank, regarding Robert Woods, are we going to look back and regret how much we used him last year? I am starting to think so. What do you think about that, Coach?
Well, I think I was saying that all along. I was not only saying that on this, but I was saying that on some of the shows that I do for ESPN and other shows. A kid can only catch so many balls, and, you know, he was getting beat to death. I mean, and not only that, he was returning kickoffs. I mean, I think he's a great athlete, and you got to utilize him, but you can't beat the kid up. Everybody wants to knock him out of the game. So, and when you run that little bubble screen that he caught so many of, he didn't have really anywhere to go because the sideline's there, so everybody took great shots at him, legal shots, not illegal shots. And after a period of time, they discovered that they had other receivers that if you do spread the love and spread the field a bit, he even becomes a better player. And they discovered Marquise Lee, they discovered the tight end, they discovered that they could run the football, which they didn't believe in running the football. And, you know, I've always said this, I think that records are great, but winning is better. And I think that you have to be able to utilize all your players. What are all these great recruiting classes for? You've got to utilize them. Records are something that, you know, you catch 6 touchdown passes in a game. Great, you break a record. But did you get better doing it as a football team? And what you try to do every week is get better. Get better so that when that challenge comes that you have to win that football game like the Oregon game came, they were prepared. They were prepared. They had their running game. They believed in themselves, and they were able to go into Eugene and win that football game. You know, if the Anthony Thomas doesn't run that kickoff back, it's 31-14, and I was looking at the fans in the stands. Hey, man, those guys, a good thing they had a weapons search before he went into the stadium because they would have killed themselves. They could not believe what they were seeing happening in their stadium.
That's true, and it started with running the football. And I think that's where the first question came from, Coach, is that they're worried, you know, if people are worried about the lack of depth at the running back spot, how does USC move it around? That they put 3 wide receivers out there. But I want people to remember, like, a guy like Simo Vinukau, what do you think about someone like him taking some turns and running the football as well? Say, you know, a DJ Morgan and a Curtis McNeil get banged up. I mean, you might see a guy like you know, Simo Vinukau coming in and getting to carry the ball like we saw Stanley Avili do a while back.
Well, let me tell you, there aren't many teams in the country that have more running backs than SC has. Now, it's great to have 5 or 6 of them, but when you have 5 or 6 of them, you really have morale problems. I'll tell you, DJ Allen right now, or DJ Morgan right now, is a turf toe, but he'll be back ready to play. DJ's a great back out of high school. I mean, everybody in the country wanted this kid. So, you know, you've got to realize what type of player he is, and you got to challenge him to become that type of player. Curtis McNeil, he's not big, but he's tough. Block for him. Let him fall forward. Let him make those yards. Share the love a little bit with Allen. Now, Buck Allen in the spring, I thought, was pretty impressive in the spring game. So give him a lot of reps. Get him ready to go. Show him the confidence you need. And like you said, the big fullback kid impressed me in the spring.
Simo Vinukau, yeah. Simo Vinukau, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that for me. But, you know, really, it's always great to have 5 great players, but you don't always have great 5 great players. So you protect them. You hope there isn't any injuries that happen. You know, freak things happen. You're going to have injuries. It's like Kennard. You know, in the weight room, trying to get ready to play, tears his muscle. You know, those things happen. It's terrible. And then you have some years where you don't have any injuries. So you just hope that that's not a start of something. You just hope that everybody stays healthy. And if your number's called, you're ready to play. And I heard they were going to move Nelson Aguilar to running back. At least that's what I read. I don't know if it's going to happen. And he's an outstanding player. And who knows what might happen on this red kid from Penn State. So things will work out.
Yeah, we're going to talk about – we got some questions on Red we'll get to in a couple minutes. And Lane Kiffin did say that Nelson Aguilar will play running back. Don't know if that's – I mean, I think that's mostly just because of the depth situation there, and that could change if Silas Red ends up coming to USC. But, Coach, I don't know if you got to see some of these summer workout videos, but when you see him playing wide receiver, he just reminds you of a special player like a Marquise Lee or a Robert Woods. It's tough for me to see them – moving him from wide receiver, where he's completely awesome, he's just ridiculously good, to running back, where maybe he's going to be good there as well, but he just looks so good at wide receiver. It's tough to see him move.
I agree with that. I didn't really like that when they said they were going to move him. I tell you, I've seen him. I saw him in high school, where he was a primary running back and receiver. He's a great athlete. A lot of people think he was the best. He was the best athlete in Florida a year ago. That came to USC. A lot of the publications. And he's the type of kid that will play whatever you ask him to play, which is great. So yeah, he is a great athlete, and he's the type of kid you can't redshirt. He's just too good. He's just too good to redshirt, and everybody knows that. But where does he play? Who becomes number three receiver? What happens to Blackwell and Florinor? I mean, there's so many players out there at that position that it's puzzling. It is. It's tremendous. The greatest group of receivers in the country.
All right. Well, let's go. We're going to move on. There's an interesting question here, Coach. Let's go to Greg. And he was rewatching, which I think a lot of USC fans probably do often, the 50-0 beatdown that USC put on UCLA last year. He said, I was watching that game the other night. Noticed on the kickoff, after USC scores the first touchdown, the UCLA kickoff receiver, McDonald, number seven, touches the UCLA kickoff receiver, McDonald, number seven, touches the ball while still in bounds on the one-yard line. The ball bounces off his left hand, goes into the end zone where he picks up the ball and takes a knee. The ruling on the field was a touchback. Why is something like that not a safety? That's from Greg.
Well, that's a good question. And I have to admit this to everyone. I didn't always know all the rules, but I argued like I did, okay? I would get in the official's face and try to, you know, say, wow, can that be? You're wrong, you know, and all the little statements that coaches say. Now, I would think as the question was presented, I would say, hey, you touched the ball, went into the end zone. You got to run it out. And I probably said that when I saw it. Did I ever ask an official about it? No. But maybe we can check and find out exactly what the ruling is on that and find out why, because I'm really interested to know that, and I think that's a good question.
I think
myself?
I think it has to do with actually controlling the ball. Like if it just touches you, like on a punt, it's different. When it touches you, it's a live ball. This is already a live ball. I think if someone touches it and it squirts into the end zone, if they catch it and then it goes in the end zone, that's one thing. But if it just touches them, I believe that's what the rule is, that you didn't have control and you can still take a knee in the end zone. There seems to be a little more wiggle room when you're talking about a kickoff than something on a punt. That's at least my understanding, yeah. But we can kind of look that up too. I wasn't sure in your coaching years if you came across that rule before, but I love to hear the fact that if you didn't know the rule, you argued about it anyway.
I argued about it anyway because he went against me, see. But if it had gone for me, I said, good call, good call, good call. You know the book, you know the book. But I don't know that. But see, you know, if that ball would have been recovered, it would have been the kickoff team's ball. So
yeah.
I don't know.
It's funny, the ball goes into like the end zone and they kind of blow it dead a lot of times. Like in high school, if it just crosses the goal line, then it's over. But in college, there definitely seems to be opportunity or times when they just kind of let the ball go and it goes out the back and the sprint team coming down is trying to pick the ball up and they just kind of whistle it dead. I'm not sure exactly what it is. Probably, though, if he touched it, it goes into the end zone and the offensive team recovers it, just like normal. The kicking team would get a touchdown on that. But it's interesting. We'll try to check on that. But I do think if you can still down it unless you've controlled it outside of the goal line. If you made some kind of play on the ball and you've controlled it, and then you go back in the end zone, that would be a safety, from my understanding. But we can double check for you.
Yeah, I'd like to find that. I wish I got this question last week because I was talking with Tony Carreni, who's the coordinator of officials for the Pac-12, and I would have just flat asked him, you know, what that rule was. But we'll try to find out for you. At least Ryan will try to find out for
try,
you.
Yeah.
He has all those contacts with the officials. The officials won't talk to me.
One last thing before we get to the – we'll finish off with Silas Red. Yeah, you still have that bad blood there, Coach. Rich, class of 68 from Bishop. He's like, I'm a fan of the podcast, but he's also an island dweller. He is in a small island in the Eastern High Sierra. I'm curious how Coach Harvey Hyde commutes. Do you have your own boat? And if you so, do you fish? Does the big white steamer still run? Thanks and fight on from Rich.
No, the big white steamer is retired. It's in some harbor half sunk in Mexico. I don't know exactly which port it is in, but occasionally in the Islander newspaper in Catalina, they show pictures of it. Everybody remembers it and so on. No, I don't have my own boat. Catalina is absolutely fantastic. I just returned last night from there. And I've been going there for a long period of time. And as you say, once you get used to a place, you don't need to go far if you have an enjoyable time. And I like it there because I'm still able to get back here right away. I'll go to Vegas tomorrow. I'll come back. I could be back to Catalina if I need to, or L.A. or practice. And it's an easy trip. I'll go over there Thanksgiving weekend, but I'll be back for the Notre Dame game in plenty of time. So it's an easy commute, yet it's a beautiful place to be, and that's why I go there.
All right. What is the big white steamer? Was that like an old boat that used to go to Catalina?
Yeah, a big steamer that everybody, it was a way to get to Catalina in the old days.
Okay.
Everybody would get on. It took about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours. And when you docked, the kids would dive for coins and you'd throw it out and there was a band on the boat. And
oh, wow.
It was really, it was like a cruise ship, a miniature cruise ship, okay? And it was the thing to do. And now you get over there in 1 hour and 10 minutes. So
yeah.
It's just beautiful. You've been over there. It's just a quick trip. But in those days, it was a romantic island of romance. Might still be, I don't know. And where people went, got married, honeymooned, you know, the whole package.
Right. Okay.
Movie stars used to hang out there
exactly,
all the time.
Exactly, yeah.
They still do. Let me tell you something weird that happened there last week. Katy Perry's a big, big, big thing now in the music world.
Right.
She showed up over there, went in the El Galleon restaurant where they have karaoke, and got up on the stage and sang.
That's pretty impressive.
That is absolutely, could not believe what was going on. And it's a true fact. So, you know, she's a good girl. And to do that in public like that is something special. So that's the place. That's what makes the place. It's special.
All right. Well, the last topic, Coach, we have a couple questions on this. Silas Redd, the junior, true junior from Penn State, a lot of talk about him transferring out. He's still on campus as we're recording this right now. He arrived on Saturday, taking his official visit. So he was, you know, paid for a flight out here from USC. His family came out on their own dime. So he's out here visiting. We have some interesting questions about it. Two of the things, one is Paul from Burbank. He said, I don't like the idea of entertaining Silas Redd at all. Chemistry, chemistry, chemistry. We came in relying on Curtis and DJ. We should stay with that. We don't need outsiders. And then West had a similar take. He said, this is my two cents, but I don't like the Silas Redd move at all. If USC does have a great season, it'll be all about Joe Paterno. The story is awful. Put an asterisk on the season in USC. Coaches didn't think this one through. They're focused on winning, but this was one story USC would have done itself a favor by steering clear of. My alumni vote is no way. So a couple interesting takes. Most people seem to want to bring Silas Redd on to the program, but at least a few people don't really think it's a good idea. What do you think?
Well, let me tell you. First of all, you got to keep the emotion, that thing out of it, about Joe Paterno, this, that, whatever. You got to do it. He said it's about winning, and this is what it's about, winning. Can you get better with Silas Redd? Yes, you can get better. Can you take the stress off of Nelson Aguilar and he can stay at receiver? If one of the backs get hurt, now you have someone there else ready to play. Does it hurt the freshman recruits that you have, Ty Isaac and Justin Davis? I wouldn't think so. The reason why I say that, I really believe if he comes, he's a one-year shot. He'll come in 1 year, and he'll be out of there the next year, and he'll be in the NFL. He rushed for 1,241 yards at Penn State. He's a north-south runner. SC needs a north-south runner. I think you become a better football team. I think the football team would embrace him. You know, competition is what competition is all about. Him even coming to USC, he has to think about, first of all, what it means to him and look at what he's doing to go to USC. He's leaving Penn State where they're making all this commitment as far as stay together, we're going to play together, we're Penn Staters and all this and that, which is true. But let's evaluate Penn State. Their offensive line is going to be average. They lost most of their offensive line. He wants to get into the NFL. So he comes to USC where they have an outstanding team, chance to win a national championship, and a returning offensive line. He's got to look at himself as far as what the morale is going to be at Penn State. And yes, they might win some games this year, but I'm going to tell you, in about 3 years, they're going to be 3-8. They're going to be this and that. People don't believe that, but, you know, you can go along with all that emotion and talk about it. We're staters, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. But it doesn't happen. That's all a marketing tool right now, okay? So, you know, myself, I wouldn't want to lose him if I was Bill O'Brien. I wouldn't want to lose him at all. I'd talk to him, but I wouldn't stand in his way either, because if he comes to Penn State, what if he gets injured there and you stopped him from going to USC or continuing his career? It's got to be his decision. And his teammates can't put pressure on him either. So, you know, SC's been in that boat. They know exactly what is right. How many people came to SC's defense? How many people stood up and said, we're not going to recruit any players from USC? Man, no one.
Yeah.
How many people stood up and said they were penalized too harshly? No one, hardly, okay? So if this is a way for USC to win a national championship and make their team better, so be it. And they know what's best.
On the chemistry issue, Paul from Burbank was asking, I talked to Max Wittick almost a week ago, and yeah, they played Pop Warner football together. And he said he would come in and fit in right away. He's just the kind of guy that he knows he would get along with everyone. And it just, he said it would work out great. He's like, chemistry-wise, it wouldn't be a problem at all. So there's that. And for West, I know your alumni vote is no, but alumni don't get a vote in these kind of situations, unfortunately. So sorry that woke up. We in the media don't get a vote. It doesn't matter. It's really up to what Lane Kiffin wants to do. He's running the show. And I don't think you can, if he's making a call, he's made some really tough calls over the past 2 years where no one's had to deal with these kind of sanctions before. Obviously, he's pulled the right levers. He's pushed the right buttons. He's doing things that no one really thought he could do, where you're in the middle of the sanctions, not only surviving, but thriving, and got a shot at a national championship 10 men down. So not saying you can't question everything he's doing, but I do think if you're a big fan of this team, you should probably, I think he's earned at least the benefit of the doubt at this point, because he's going through uncharted waters and navigating them beautifully so far. If he feels that Silas Red could come in and help the situation, I think you kind of give him the benefit of the doubt that he knows what he's talking about.
And I agree. And I think that's for he's going to do what's best for the program. He's going to do what's not good for the program. If they feel that he will help them win and be a part of the team, I think the team will rally around their decision. But the team wants to win, and they know what they have to do. So I agree. I understand what he is saying as far as, you know, let's leave it alone and do it with us and have our loyalties and so on. But I used to always tell my players, if you allow somebody to come in and beat you out, and you've been here 3 years, 4 years, and I said, and I can go out and recruit somebody, every day I go out to try to find a better player than you. But that means we're getting better. Now you're here. If this kid can come in and camp and learn our playbook and beat you out, then it's your fault. And we're a better football team. And now these kids have a jump on this kid. And will this kid have 1,241 yards? Probably not. But the kid will make USC a better football team, enhance his NFL career, and move on. Now, is he coming? I have no idea if he's coming. If he decides not to come, then that's what he decides to do, and he does not come. But at least he has that opportunity to look at USC and decide. I didn't even look at Jordan Hill, their defensive end. SC just lost a defensive end. They've got a defensive end back there. In some publication, they've got him preseason All-Big Ten, second team All-Big Ten, 6'2", 280, 90 pounds. Probably a pretty good football player. So when you look at me and ask me that question, I have an obligation to win. I have an obligation as a head football coach to get the best players I can. And it's within the structure of the NCAA rules. So not only would I look at Silas Red, I look at Jordan Hill, the defensive end there at Penn State too.
And Coach, I want to make one other clarification, too. I don't think you bring in a Silas Red and you make a championship run, it's going to be about Penn State and Joe Paterno. There's too many storylines. USC is a bigger program than Penn State right now. Unless Silas Red runs for like 2,000 yards and goes absolutely crazy, it's not going to be about him. I mean, it's going to be about Matt Barkley making a run at the Heisman. It's going to be about Marquise Lee coming on strong. I think he's going to have an absolutely monster year. Probably going to be about how this defense gets better. There's going to be a lot of different storylines. I don't think Silas Red will be a piece. It wouldn't like Silas Red would come on and be Reggie Bush and dominate everything. I just don't see that happening. So I don't think that the whole story is going to be about, well, USC is only good because they got Silas Red. I just don't think it could be further from the truth.
I agree 100% because he's got to come in. First of all, no one's told him he's a starting tailback. He's got to come in and earn that. I would say right now he wouldn't start the first game.
No, certainly.
And he'd probably be two or three on the depth chart. Him and DJ Morgan would alternate. So that's some of the things he has to understand, too, when he comes to USC so he doesn't get misled. So, you know, how can it hurt you?
Right. Well, along the lines, when we just keep checking with USCfootball.com, we will be getting all kinds of updates of what's going on. Check the peristyle, dropping little tidbits of information on what's going on with Silas Red as he finishes up his visit at USC. And, Coach, thanks again for coming on the show. It's always fun chatting football with you. Next week, fall camp starts, so we'll get to do a little preview of what you expect to see the few weeks of fall camp leading up to the season and the first kickoff. Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. I really can't believe it. But it's going to be a great season, and it's going to be a very challenging season for USC. I'm impressed with Washington more. And after the media day, the number one team that impressed me the most by listening to the players, I mean not just SC and others and so on, but to listen to the players and the philosophy of the coaches, Utah has a real confidence feeling on the stage. They really have a confident feeling. When you talk to the players, and I hear Kyle Whittingham talk about his team. Now, USC has to go to Utah. And I'm telling you, they didn't just blow them out last year either. So that is now one of the games that is going to be another difficult game on USC's schedule. I really was impressed with his presentation.
Yeah, I was too, Coach. That's a big one. That's the one people ask me about games that that USC should be concerned about. I think I forgot to mention that a few times. That is certainly going to be a tough one going to Utah. But all right, Coach, thanks again. Thanks to our sponsor, Southern California Tickets, and everyone else. We'll be back in 30 seconds talking with USCfootball.com beat writer Dan Weber.
Meet us on the other side of the break for more of the Peristyle Podcast. Tickets, tickets, tickets. SC Tickets is your concert, sports, and theater ticket source. We have the tickets you need to any event worldwide. Football tickets are now available. Call SC Tickets now at 1-800-888-7287, 1-800-888-7287. That's 1-800-888-7287. Or visit us on the web at sctickets.com. SC Tickets, concert, sports, and theater. We now return to the Peristyle Podcast and your host, Ryan Abraham.
We are back here on the Peristyle Podcast, joined by USCfootball.com beat writer Dan Weber, who was at Pac-12 Media Day along with the rest of the USCfootball.com staff. What's going on, Dan? How's it going?
Hey, I'm kind of working on a piece. I've kind of held on to it for about 5 or 6 days, sitting next to Larry Scott and talking to him about what it's like to be the commissioner of the Pac-12 with USC back, because he's never had that situation. Heck, he's never had a situation where USC could even go to a bowl game. I think people might be a little surprised. I tried three or four different ways to get him to open up about how he feels about USC and the Pac-12, and I think people will find it a little interesting as to how Larry looks at things.
Now, we never got a picture of Larry Scott with the three USC representatives there, Lane Kiffin, T.J. McDonald, and Matt Barkley, who he reprimanded all of them.
Larry never even talked about them. You had to really push Larry to even go there. Larry doesn't go there. And one of the things that brought it up was watching another Pac-12 network video that looked like it could have been a recruiting video for Oregon or Stanford. And was that USC? I think I saw him in there. I'm not sure. You know, that's like the third one. And you keep thinking, okay, three times, probably not a coincidence. Not just bad luck. Not just, you know. But there is an actual specific issue that Larry has with USC and the Pac-10, the Pac-12 now, that people, I think, will find interesting. So
we'll look for that.
Have that later today.
Okay.
As to how Larry looks at USC and the rest of the pack.
Well, it's been a crazy week. Every week this summer seems to be crazy. There's always stuff going on. There's a lot of recruiting stuff. We did skip the recruiting podcast last week, but we'll bring it back again this week. And of course, fall camp starts next week. But maybe get a few of your thoughts from what went down on Pac-12 Media Day.
Well, it was interesting. I thought Lane is so good at what he does. He was the only, for example, coach of the Pac-12 that figured out a way to mention recruiting. And Lane, I think the thing we always thought about Lane was no one understands how recruiting really works with your entire program and that you can't separate it even a little bit from the direction of the program, and that it's something you're always thinking about and always doing, but doing it in the context of this is how we do our program. And I think it was interesting. He was ready. He had his pitch that clearly, you know, you could interpret as, you know, when you're talking about lack of depth at running back, you don't have to name any names, but you know, it was very clear, and he's the only coach that was able to incorporate recruiting into his basic, you know, talk about how this is what our program is, this is who we are, this is how we do it. I mean, some of the coaches essentially didn't even want to talk about, you know, even have an opening statement. They basically just said, you know, go ahead and ask me some questions, whereas Lane's got an opening statement that, you know, hits every single base. And there's a reason he is where he is and he's doing what he's doing. It's not good luck and it's not an accident.
It certainly is not. And he just keeps impressing us, I guess. If you watch him, what he's working and the kind of how his hands have been tied behind his back, he just seems to just keep going forward. And there's a lot to prove this season, of course, but we'll have to see what happens there.
I think the general thrust, and this is probably a good thing for guys, our guys on the P and USCfootball.com to understand, is what Lane has done. He's taken every negative that's come his way and turned it into a positive. It's kind of amazing. And it is probably instructive for some of, you know, as much as we love all the new posters and the multi-posters and all of the other things, you probably, if you look at Lane, you don't spend a lot of time saying, the sky is falling, oh my God, what are we going to do now? That isn't what Lane's done. I mean, stuff has happened that he wasn't expecting, that nobody was expecting, and he figured out how to turn it into a positive. But last week, you know, DJ Morgan, we find out, stubbed his toe at the Coliseum, got, you know, turf toe to, and is in a boot. And there's all kinds of posts of people saying, we have to change all the way we're recruiting, or we got to do this, or we got to do that. And you just think, come on, guys, get a grip. You can handle it. It'll be okay. Because that's basically how, you know, how this program has handled it. They figured out a way to make it okay. And the Devon, you know, Kennard situation, you know, and not to say, I mean, he's probably one of the absolute greatest kids, you know, in this program and that you're ever going to see. But it's not the end of the world, and there are probably ways in which USC may face, you know, the loss of Devon for however long that is, and to try to diagnose those things before they've even gone in for surgery is really a little premature. But there may be ways that this works as a positive, that more guys get involved sooner, and that by the end of the year, they're stronger at that, you know, at that position than they would have been. So, you know, I would think at this point in time, you basically kind of look at these things and say, how are they going to turn this into an advantage here? And probably a good chance that they will.
He's doing whatever he can. Well, you touched on the Devon Kennard situation. He tore a pectoral muscle, is scheduled for surgery this morning, or today, Monday. It's interesting to see. I mean, I talk a lot about Kevin Green. He's been in the program a long time, hasn't played football all that much. People talk about Morgan Breslin, the transfer in, or Leonard Williams, the true freshman. What do you think is going to happen there at the defensive end position?
Well, I mean, I think it's a perfect chance to get USC into the you know, the really strong rotation where they really want to. I mean, they really did admire how much more, for example, Oregon got out of their talent on defense by playing 25 guys basically every game and extending, you know, the talent. Now, USC has a whole lot more talent in a lot of ways, or certainly than that Oregon team did, you know, starting a couple of years ago when they started doing it. And so I think the blend of, if you look at, you know, Leonard Williams, the freshman, and Greg Townsend Jr., redshirt freshman, and Morgan Breslin with the speed that he's got, even though, you know, he hasn't played against competition at all like this, a real hard worker, serious kid. And then Kevin Green, who there may not be a more, you know, physically talented in terms of, you know, speed and strength, and a, you know, serious hard worker, or just hasn't had a chance to play a whole lot of football, started late in high school. But that's four right there. And that we're not even talking about Christian Thomas yet or Junior Pomay, both of whom at one time or another were, you know, tight ends, physically very gifted tight ends who were considered as possibilities on defense. So that's six right there. And, you know, that's what good teams do. You don't necessarily and so many people say, oh, my gosh, this is where that depth thing is really going to catch us. Look at it. With 75 scholarships, you weren't going to be replacing, let's say, an injured veteran senior who goes down is not going to be replaced by someone from scholarship number 76 through 85. So the whole depth issue and the sanctions issue and the limitations and all that doesn't really apply. And people, I don't think, you know, should say that. They've got a lot of good, you know, athletes who are going to get a chance quicker. And I do think Devon clearly wants to come back, even if it's for the final three or four games, or if it's the final couple of games in the regular season, really obviously big, big, big games, and then another, you know, break until a bowl game. If he could get three or four games at the end of the year to showcase himself for the NFL to say, look, I'm back, I'm fine, I'm healthy, I think that's what he would do. That's what USC would like to do. And, you know, by that time, let's, you know, hope that most of those other kids have had a, you know, a chance to also work their way in. So I'm not sure, you know, you go all negative about, you know, the thing to think about, I think, with Devon is you just really wish the best. What a wonderful kid. Great athlete, great student, really athletic kid. He's worked real hard. He's had, you know, he made the switch to middle linebacker, then he had to come back. Got, you know, has had three kind of major injuries, and hasn't had a, you know, any real, you know, real good breaks as far as being at USC, and had an injury in high school. So he's not been a real lucky kid, and we just, you know, hope the best for him this year, and that when he's ready to come back, they're able to just, you know, bring him back, you know, just enough to really allow him to show that, you know, that he's completely healed.
Well, we do have some more Penn State talk to get to, some questions. And, okay. And the initial article you wrote about a week ago kind of calling out the NCAA. Here's a caller. I think you probably just addressed this real quick, but this caller seemed to think that you were taking a shot at Duke lacrosse when I definitely do not think that's what you're doing. Here's the question.
Huge fan of the show. I just want to let you know, Dan Weber, I just read their last article about Penn State. You might want to get your facts right about the Duke lacrosse team. They were not guilty. There's nothing guilty about it. You shouldn't be smearing people's, you know, reputations in the mud and nothing happened. I'm a huge fan of the show. Fight on. Forever a Trojan. Come on, Dan. Show some class.
I thought that was kind of
okay,
funny.
I'm going to try not to be mean here. I already addressed this on the P, but clearly the point of bringing Duke lacrosse in was that they were innocent. And look what happened. Had a body like the NCAA jumped in. I mean, the district attorney in Durham, North Carolina, was using them to win an election. The faculty at Duke, 88 members, signed a petition that these privileged kids, you know, were guilty of, you know, rape and what the, that's, you know, and everybody, is a, you know, they were running public opinion and trying to bury those kids on that Duke lacrosse team who were innocent. And that was the point. I don't want to see the NCAA, you know, get all ginned up like they did in the USC case by public opinion and by journalists who have no idea what they were doing, or in the Duke lacrosse case. That was the point. Maybe someone missed the point, which was we do not want the NCAA to jump in where it really doesn't have jurisdiction into civil matters that are being handled civilly and legally and in court just because they think they're going to get ahead of the parade and look like big shots. What if they'd have jumped into the Duke lacrosse case and thrown down all these kinds of penalties? Now, obviously, Duke is one of their favorites, so they would have had a harder time doing that. But that's the point. I don't want they're not geared to do this. They didn't do an investigation in the NCAA or in the Penn State case. They just jumped, piggybacked onto the free report and what they were able to pick up from the Sandusky trial. Well, what if, you know, finally the truth came out in the Duke lacrosse case? But what if it wouldn't have come out quick enough for the NCAA to have been stampeded in there and handed out some terrible penalties? That's the point. They were innocent. That's why we cited the Duke lacrosse case. We do not want the NCAA going into places where it just delegates that it has authority to go, where it doesn't. So reread it, take a deep breath, think about it before you throw out those kinds of charges. Hey, maybe there's a job for you at the NCAA.
Ouch, Dan. Okay.
Well, come on.
I know. That's awesome, though. That's you know, it's funny. People go to headlines sometimes. They assume they know what the article means, or they read part of it, or they read a sentence and don't continue on, and then, you know, then they jump to conclusions. Or someone tells them on Facebook, hey, this company's doing this or something, you know, and people just run with it and they have no idea. And then they read it and they're like, oh, wait.
Yeah, there was contact. Because basically, you know, you can have situations where there are real tragedies and somebody's at fault, and then there are other situations where somebody's not at fault. The common bond there was people were getting, you know, publicly outraged about something that has some connection to college sports. And do we want the NCAA jumping in wherever there's enough public outrage about something? I mean, they've proven they have no ability to do fair investigations or do competent investigations or do honest investigations. Essentially, as they proved in the Penn State case, in their negotiations with Penn State, they've already decided on a verdict. They had, you know, evidently, according to the president of Penn State, they told him, if you don't take this, you don't sign a consent decree and agree to our penalties here, we'll have a trial, we'll do an investigation, and then we'll give you the four-year death penalty. Hello? How do you do that? How do you come up with a penalty that you threaten Penn State with before you've had your investigation? What world is that? That's not America. Where is that fair? But that's what the NCAA did. We do not want, I don't think, anything like that getting into any of these areas. We want the NCAA to stay out.
I agree. All right. Well, let's go to, we had a couple questions on this. There's a lot of Penn State talk, and if you've read the Peristyle or my Twitter feed at Inside Troy, I get a lot of scholarship questions and things come up. And you know, just to reiterate, USC hasn't played a single game under scholarship sanctions. From 25 to 15, we saw that on the last signing day, but not the 75 limit playing on the field with only 75 players, scholarship players as opposed to 85. So it's going to be the first game against Hawaii. So you will see for the very first time USC play with only 75 instead of 85. And Penn State still got a couple years before they see their limits down to 65. But we're getting a lot of questions on the differences. And for the most part, everything that happens with Penn State is worse, except in this one instance, and Terrian has a question on it, Dan, we can talk about it. He says, unlike our sanctions, all current Penn State players, freshmen through seniors, can transfer and play immediately. Do either of you know if they can transfer any time over their careers, or do they have an expiration date to make their decision?
There's an expiration date more than a year away. It's sometime in 2013.
I think it's right before like camp or something in 2013.
I think next camp. So they think they have all of this year and into next August, September area, something like that. Probably next September, I think, is the date. But, yeah, it actually is specified. The thing, I think one of the things that bothered Lane so much was they never really specified that in the USC case. That was kind of the first time they'd done it the way they did it with USC. I mean, we had these scenarios where a team on the quarter system that didn't start their semester or quarter, until October sometime, that a kid could be at USC one day and transfer to the team USC was playing the next, and the NCAA didn't have any real rules about that. So that was one of the things I think that really made the USC staff unhappy about the lack of specificity in terms of when kids could transfer and when they couldn't. So at least they made that more specific in terms of the Penn State case. Although, they can transfer, for a year. Yeah,
oh,
they
I'm
can
sorry.
Transfer for a year. And but there are the rules are written now more specifically. The killer, I think, for Penn State is that they're allowed to transfer within the Big Ten Conference. That was a gigantic, that was the best thing the Pac-10 or Pac-12 has ever done for USC, is that rule that you can't transfer within the conference. It would have been a much more difficult thing, I think, for USC if kids could have transferred within the conference, and it's going to be a difficult thing for Penn State. And it's kind of amazing when you see that Illinois shows up on campus with a half a dozen coaches. That would make it really tough if I'm Penn State to continue my relationship, I think, with the Big Ten. But that's another big difference. But that wasn't an NCAA ruling. That was a Pac-12 that has gone back, for years, that you can't transfer within the conference without another year of ineligibility.
And the other aspect of that, too. So for USC players, just to make it clear, Terry, there was no specification. So a junior could have transferred halfway through his senior year, and it would have been okay. But for the Penn State players, even the freshmen, they really only have a year to decide. So even though, when they're a junior, they can't decide, I'm going to transfer at this point. But for this year, what the special stipulation is that if you do want to transfer to another program this year and still be able to play, you can do that until you play in a game. So you can go through Penn State camp, and if you don't like it or something happens or whatever, then you can transfer at that point and be eligible right away. I mean, there's still like the academic side. You have to worry about all that stuff. But Until you play.
One of the scenarios is that in game one, every player dressed will play. The Penn State will clear the bench.
Yeah, very well could.
That's one of the absolute theories is if you dress that first game, you're playing. Because they're not dressing you and then letting you decide, oh, I didn't get enough playing time. You know, I didn't get any playing time in game one. I'm out of here. That's not going to happen. I think if you're ready to go, you're going to get in that game.
Well, let's go to Don Q and Escondido. And this is kind of it's similar. There's a lot of scholarship talk and there's a lot of different rules. And Dan and I were discussing this actually before the podcast. But Don wants to know, Penn State's scholarship reduction penalty includes a stipulation that they can remain at their limit of 65 if necessary by giving scholarships to walk-on players already on the team. Do you know if USC's limit of 75 scholarships includes this similar provision? And he quotes one of the rules, and it cites one of the NCAA bylaws, and we did a little bit of research on this. And Dan, you can start off. We can both kind of explain this.
Well, I guess that was another example of what the NCAA did evidently go to school when USC kept asking them questions about, well, what's allowed, what's not allowed, blah, blah, blah. Because they didn't bother to write those things down when they penalized USC. They just sort of, you know, you were trying to figure out what exactly did Paul D say in the press conference. The one qualification that Ryan came up with on that rule is that those walk-ons that are in the program have to have been in school 2 academic years. But what it does is it makes a kid like Ryan Dillard, the freshman from Atlanta defensive back, who honestly, I mean, from what we have seen, as good as all of these, you know, defensive backs USC's recruiting, they're not recruiting anybody any better than Ryan Dillard. And one would think that, Ryan Dillard will have a scholarship waiting for him, when that time comes. And that makes, being able to, have a kid like that walk on his own, pay his way, it's really, really important. Now, there may not be a whole lot of slots next year, but the year after, one would think that will be the way that you're able to keep and say, well, we have 75 scholarship players, because the limitation of only 15 new grants, and the same thing at Penn State, that taking it all the way down to 15, which is kind of interesting that they took USC to 15 and then for a much more egregious, violation that the NCAA determined they had to have sort of an emergency, semi-death penalty on Penn State. They still couldn't make themselves go any lower than 15 a year. So the 15 against USC was just ridiculously overdone. But it was designed almost to put you below the scholarship limitation. So it was a second penalty. And so the way they allow themselves to say, but, oh, you can have enough bodies, you just give some to walk-ons. Luckily for USC, that's what they've always done. And when you say, for example, USC has to go to 75, they've not been very much over 80 for most of the years that Pete was here. And certainly, not the last couple of years. They've been going with a fairly lean, roster. So it's not as big an adjustment for USC. I don't know if you saw the scholarship numbers, the rankings numbers in Rival comparing USC's last 4 classes with Alabama's, and where they've basically shared, I think in the last 9 years, USC's had 4 top recruiting classes in Rivals, Alabama's had 4, and I think maybe Florida had 1. But in order for Alabama, and I didn't do all the math, but in order for Alabama to basically have the same number of points USC has, they recruited like 25 more players.
In 4 years.
Scholarship, yeah. Like 20 or 25 more players. So USC hasn't been over-scholarshipping over the years. So USC's not in the habit of needing all those extra bodies. It would be a much more significant – I mean, if you put an SEC school on a 15 scholarship limitation – it would be a unbelievably unmanageable penalty, I think, for him. USC, at least, is probably the school in the country that has the best chance of handling a 15, but probably still will have to elevate a kid like a Ryan Dillard in another year or so.
I just want to clarify this a little bit, and I know there's confusion on both sides a lot of times, but when you're talking about the two-year thing that Dan mentioned, each player can count as an initial counter and a total counter. The initial count, USC's down to 15 from 25, and the total is 75 from 85. So a guy like Ryan Dillard who comes in, say USC wanted to give him a scholarship next year, he'd only been in the program 1 year as a walk-on and a non-recruited walk-on. That makes a difference too. There's all these different clarifications. So a non-recruited walk-on, meaning he didn't take an official visit, wasn't given a national letter of intent to sign, things like that. So USC didn't recruit him, quote unquote. I mean, you can make phone calls and things like that, but not do what a lot of the official visit stuff goes on. If he gets a scholarship after 1 year, he still has to count as an initial counter.
Initial.
So he'll count as against the 15 one of those years that he came in, which is what you're trying to avoid. So in a case like his and any of the other walk-ons that are coming in, once they're in the program for 2 years, they're non-recruited. They can get all kinds of academic aid and need-based aid, but they can't get any athletic aid. So they're non-recruited. They got this need-based aid. So they can do okay for 2 years, getting as much financial aid as you possibly can. Then in the third year, when USC comes off of the sanctions, they'll have 10 extra scholarships to hand out. Those guys would be prime candidates to get one of those scholarships because they've been in the program 2 years. They will not be an initial counter at all. They would just count towards the overall number, which is now bumped up to 85. And it won't hurt USC bringing in new commits from that group because they won't be counted as that initial counter. And it's exactly
that'll be an interesting newsworthy year because potentially now the way USC doesn't run kids off and all of that kind of thing, not by the boxcar full or anything, but they'll be able to offer 25 new scholarships and elevate some of the walk-ons who really proved themselves. So that'll be an interesting dynamic. I'm not sure after going through a few limited numbers years, it'll be interesting to see what the heck do they do with when they've got 25 scholarships and maybe a kid or two like Ryan Dillard that also can get a scholarship. There won't be enough days in the week for Gerard to chronicle that.
It gets to be a little confusing. There's a lot of different rules here. But I think, Lincoln's not going to say what his plan is, but it does seem like bringing in some higher profile, quote unquote, walk-ons this year, it really sets them up to help, in 2 years when they go back up to 85, it's hard to get up there right away. But, you have a few really good walk-ons that by that point could be contributing, members of the team, and they could get a scholarship. What it really hurts, and Dan and I talked about this in the, off the record, before the podcast came on, and Michael Lev did a good little piece on, he talked to one of the walk-ons that currently has a scholarship that was willing to give up that scholarship, even though it would be devastating. Those are the kind of guys these scholarships are hurting. And, Dan talked about they never really over-scholarshiped anyone, only about 80 players, but they did have room to give deserving walk-ons a scholarship. A Cal Negrete would normally have a scholarship, but because of the NCAA sanctions, he doesn't. And, that's terrible. And maybe a guy like a Will Andrew or a Tony Burnett who came over from the track team, loses their scholarship and they would have had under normal times, but because of the sanctions, those are really the kind of people that are getting hurt. It's not about, keeping this program down or trying to, limit, recruiting. They're still able to recruit. Lane Kiffin's proving that. The guys getting hurt are the guys that really should be getting a benefit out of working hard. These are the walk-on guys.
And it's the essence of Joe Schell's, IRS challenge to the NCAA that, they basically, when they do something like this, they're working against their charter, against their mission statement that they submitted to the IRS to be tax exempt, which said that their number one goal is to promote you know, the welfare of student athletes. And Joe's challenge, and he's had a number of back and forth with the IRS over his challenge to the NCAA, and it is proceeding, is the challenge is how can an organization that says it's structured essentially to benefit and for the welfare of student athletes that takes away scholarships from completely innocent, completely deserving student athletes, how can that organization be really living up to its stated charter? And that if it's not, then it doesn't deserve tax-exempt status. It'll be an interesting challenge because now I think the whole state of Pennsylvania, and when you're talking the difference between, say, Penn State and USC, there are two senators and there are probably a dozen congressmen and a whole lot of people involved in, you know, in this election. Pennsylvania is a swing state. It's a battleground state. So there are some political implications about the NCAA's conduct in the Penn State case in terms of just doing something just because they wanted to and making up the rules, not that Penn State didn't, you know, participate in just beyond belief, horrific, cover-up and, something that deserved every kind of, condemnation that somebody could give it, but was the NCAA... You know, and taking 20 scholarships away a year from kids that were in grade school or, you know, not even in grade school. Some of those kids were lucky. They were even barely born by the time, you know, when they Jerry Sandusky's, first situation in 1998 was kind of, not discovered in a way that it should have been. How is that benefiting the welfare of student athletes by doing what the NCAA did to Penn State? It just seems like their whole penalty model is completely askew, that penalize the innocent, penalize the ones who weren't involved, penalize the weak guys, the students that don't have any representation. That just doesn't seem right.
All right, Dan. Well, we got to run. We're at our limit for the show, but thanks again for sharing your insight and maybe it'll be another interesting week for USC football. We'll see.
Man, oh, man. Man, you almost have to have a law degree and three other degrees, I think, to cover college sports at this level. USC's a trendsetter. I mean, they're involved in every discussion about college football these days. There's nothing where they can talk about it that USC isn't a reference point of some sort.
Yeah. All right, well, Dan, thanks again. And everyone else, thank you very much for tuning into the Peristyle Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show, and we'll talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.